The world of work is changing rapidly, and in this podcast, we're examining the challenges and possibilities emerging within this change. We're talking about everything from labor market information to how to enable the thinking and doing that leads to better workforce development and employment outcomes. This is the Workforce Collective Podcast. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Workforce Collective Podcast. I'm your host, Caleb Meeks, content creator and marketing assistant for Workforce Collective, and today I'm joined by our call-in guest, Pamela Upal-Sandhu, Director of Policy at Ontario Nonprofit Networks. Today we're discussing ONN's fourth sector survey about the ever-so-important nonprofit sector titled 2023 State of the Sector Survey at a Tipping, and how it relates to the findings of our most recent brief about the nonprofit sector at Workforce Collective titled From Burnout to On Fire. We're looking at the key findings from each report, issues the sector faces, and the inevitable impacts it will have on our economy if drastic changes aren't made. So first of all, Pamela, thanks for being here and for giving us your time.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Of course. So the first question, for all of us that work within the nonprofit sector, the work that we do and the purpose that nonprofits serve, it's apparent to us because that's our everyday, right? But for those not involved, maybe this not so clear. So maybe we could clear that up. What is the nonprofit sector? What does it serve? Who's it for? What role does it play in our economy?
It's a really good question to start off on, because I often get that same question from my parents, like, what do you do? Where do you work? What is this? And so I think the most important piece to stress here is that all of us, regardless of where we live in Ontario, we're connecting with nonprofits on a day-to-day basis, and we just don't realize it. A lot of the reasons why neighborhoods and communities are safe and healthy and well-being is centered is because of nonprofits. We create communities people want to live in and raise their families in. That includes communities with vibrant parks, affordable, accessible, and high-quality recreation activities, festivals, arts programming, and third spaces for kids to explore. We also provide essential services that folks rely on every day. So I'm talking about childcare, elder care, home care at home, care for people who are frail and sick. We also have community health services, mental health supports. And these sort of also fall into the bucket around services that support people when they can't support themselves or when, you know, life changes for them. And so this means, you know, employment and training services. This means gender-based violence services or family and individual counseling services. It could also mean food banks, homelessness shelters, women's shelters. All of these pieces together make up what we do. So we're not just social services, which is often the misconception, but really, you know, create this holistic, vibrant, healthy community that folks can rely on. And, you know, this has never been so apparent than the last couple of years. We were really helping communities throughout the pandemic, whether that was relaying information, connecting them to resources, or, you know, coming out of the pandemic, the affordability crisis. So many people have been turning to nonprofits on a day-to-day basis. And so that's sort of what we do and who we are. The other piece that kind of gets missed or is a misconception might be is that we don't do any economic activity when that's not true. We're such a big economic driver. So regardless if you're in Thunder Bay or Barrie or Windsor, London, even in the GTA, we play a really big role in job creation. So we have about 1 million employees in Ontario. We engage volunteers, and on top of, you know, that's all on top of providing products and services that people rely on. So just for in terms of numbers, we contribute $65 billion to our province's GDP. As I shared, we employ about 1 million people. And the other misconception is that this is all government funding, but that's not true. As a sector, we receive less than half of our revenues from government funding. And so a lot of it we leverage to do our own earned income, to do our own fees for services. We do a lot of, you know, fundraising, donation drives, et cetera. And that doesn't even quantify the social benefits we bring to communities. We actually commissioned an economic study a couple of years ago, maybe 2 years ago, because we really wanted to see what was our economic impact compared to other industries like manufacturing and auto, but also wanted to see, you know, if you invest a dollar into us, what does that mean and look like? And so one of the big pieces that came out of that was that we're pretty on par with manufacturing and auto in terms of our GDP contribution and how many people we employ. And if you invest a dollar into us, we bring back $1, you know, 50 or $2 in terms of GDP impact, employment, income, and job creation. So there's lots of, you know, benefits to investing in our sector. And I guess that's kind of what I'll end off on in terms of like what our structure really facilitates us being able to do all this work, because we're rooted in community. We're governed by a nonprofit, or sorry, a volunteer board. So really it's like people in the community are like, oh, this is a need. We have to do something about it. Come together and form a group, which becomes formalized in a nonprofit structure. We're transparent, much more accountable. Everything that we own is essentially public assets. If we were to dissolve a nonprofit or a charity, we can't sell our assets to for profit. It has to go to a municipality, public sector, or another nonprofit. So it'll always remain public. And at the core of it all is that we put people first. And needs first, not profit. We're not, you know, beholden to a bottom line or making money or making sure we're providing shareholder incentives and all of that. We reinvest everything that we get back into providing more programs and services. And that creates a lot of agility, a lot of nimbleness, a lot of diverse options. And it means that we provide services and supports and programs in communities, regardless of if we can make money off of it, right? So no matter how small the need is, no matter how if it's like five people that are going to benefit from it, or you can't make money off of it at all, that's the whole point of the structure. People coming together, being able to service that need. And so that's kind of where we always pitch that, you know, we're a ready ally. We're on the ground. We know what's happening in communities before anybody else does, which again was the case during the pandemic. And really, you know, can support people and build those healthy, vibrant communities that people want to live in ultimately.
Wow. So that sounds like nonprofits, they do have a really big impact. I like how you brought up the economic impact of that, because to a person that doesn't know anything about nonprofits, you can hear that word, just nonprofit, and you can think, well, where do you get your money then? What do you even do? How do you operate if you don't profit anything? But I like how you said that we're on par with other businesses like manufacturing and stuff. And it really sounds like if you are going for help, or if something has helped, say, build a better community, that was probably done by a nonprofit.
Yeah, yeah. And we're also filling gaps, right? Like affordable housing that's developed by nonprofits or operated by nonprofits. When we have new immigrants, migrants, refugees, it's all settlement services operated by the nonprofit sector. And so there's a lot of these different pieces that we don't realize that it's not just about making healthy, vibrant communities, but also making sure they stay healthy and vibrant. So you're supporting people, you know, through it from, what's the saying, cradle to grave, which is not the best, but throughout their life cycle.
Yeah, and that is huge. So we at Workforce Collective, we recently published a brief called From Burnt Out to On Fire, where we cover exactly what the nonprofit sector is, common issues it faces, and who majorly comprises the sector. Some of our key findings included high rates of burnout and resignation, cutbacks on programming services and the number of clients supported, increased waitlist times, and significantly lower pay rates in contrast to public and private sector workers. Did ONN find similar issues in their research? And what were the commonalities between the two?
100%. Like everything that you guys found in your report is definitely echoed and amplified in our report provincially. And I think that's what the power of it, of our surveys and our data across the board are, right? That no matter which region you're in, no matter what part of sector or subsector you're part of, which communities you serve, that we're all experiencing the same thing. It might be manifesting in different ways or showing up in nuanced ways, but it's all the same. And it's so funny because your title's kind of similar to our headline, which is we're a sector running on fumes and headed to unprecedented territory. So as you shared, we've been doing the survey for 4 years. We started during the pandemic, not thinking that this was going to be something that happens all the time. But what became really evident is that we need to continue to measure the state of the sector and the impact of broader trends on the sector so we can advocate better and also provide high quality data, which I'm sure is, you know, very similar to your work as well. And so this year we were in a unique spot because we had 4 years worth of comparable data. So we were able to sort of look at this information, be like, what's been happening over the past 4 years? And so some of the big trends really, really align with what you've already found. So one is demand. It has sharply increased. It's at an all-time high. So demand for our services right now went up 30% since 2020. So about 74% of the sector is reporting increase in demand for services. And like I said, that's up from 30% in 2020. The second piece has been around financial situations. So overall, they are on a downward spiral, which are probably contributing to more of the HR pieces that you've also already mentioned. So when I say downward spiral, what I mean is that even if, you know, half the sector or even less than that, like 40% reported some sort of marginal increase in revenue, not a lot, very small. But 90% of the sector is experiencing increase in costs, like exponential increase in costs, and everybody is experiencing an increase in demand for services. So really any slow growth of revenue, even that slowing, but any growth in revenue cannot keep up with demand for service and the cost of things, right? And more we're seeing people have to dip into their reserve funds. And that's just becomes a vicious cycle. Demand goes up, you know, your revenue isn't going up as much. And then you're trying to also cover all the increasing costs and expenses because of inflation. What I also will add is when we look at financial situations, larger organizations are different than smaller ones. Larger ones are much more likely to increase any sort of marginal increase in revenue, whereas the smaller ones, which are usually like under 3 million or under a million, even under 500,000, usually are reporting declines in revenue and are much, much smaller. So they're more vulnerable to these. The other sort of caveat I wanted to add was when we're looking at demand for services, this is overall provincial average, but if you look at particular subsectors like social services, that's much higher. If you're looking at organizations that serve equity deserving communities, our Black communities, Indigenous communities, 2SL, 2SL LGBTQIA plus communities, service increase in services through the roof. So it really highlights also who's experiencing disproportionate impact of all the broader trends that we're seeing. And then the other piece around the HR is that we started measuring it last year, really wanting to map out like what are the recruitment and retention challenges, how many people are experiencing it. And the numbers have not changed since last year. So 65% had said we're experiencing a recruitment and retention challenge last year, exactly the same number this year. So just points to nothing's shifting, nothing's changing. Even if there are some pushes internally into the sector, a lot of the HR pieces that you mentioned, burnout, wage parity, are so systemic in nature, it requires much more efforts and more coordinated collective efforts. Yeah, and I think in terms of the closures and the cutbacks and programs, we also started measuring that last year. Last year, they were at a highly like elevated crisis level. Again, like 65% around that time reporting cutbacks or discontinuing, growing waitlists, like you've mentioned. And this year, those numbers have dropped just a bit, just a couple of percentage points. People still, you know, or you can say they've plateaued at a high level. Folks are still reporting they're discontinuing programs, their waitlists are growing. And actually, we ask every year if the sector, when you're filling out the survey as a nonprofit, if you know of another one in your area, your region, your network, or, you know, if you service a similar population, has closed down. And that's at an all-time high. So 35% said that they knew of someone else that was similar to them that had closed down in the past year. And that has been the highest since we started doing the survey in 2020. And so those are just some of the high-level pieces around I think ours gives like that provincial overview and sort really supports what you're seeing in communities.
Wow. So I assume that increase has been since the pandemic. Like the pandemic had such a strong effect on everything. So now after that, there's a much higher demand for everybody. And although things may not be decreasing in terms of what we have, it's not changing. So if things don't increase with demand increases, that is not going to work.
100%. And I think the other thing to remember is that we had much more supports during the pandemic, right? As individuals, like we had CERB, but even as organizations, there was rent support, wage subsidy support. There was a lot of supports put out federally and some provincially, and all of those are gone. So that's the other context for our survey, particularly. Excuse me. People were filling it out for the past fiscal year, which is April 1, 2022 to March 31st, 2023. And all supports were gone at that point. And we'd already peaked at inflation, right? It was already at, peaked, and the affordability crisis had already started. And so that really kind of, you know, when all of this is happening and the supports, even if they were not a lot, but they were in place, when those are also taken away and you kind of can't revert back to your traditional fundraising campaigns and events and galas or just charitable giving in general, because we know that's down as well, that's when you really start to see the extreme numbers.
So then, Pamela, in ONN's fourth sector survey, it's noted that despite sharply increasing demand for services being at a high, like we just mentioned, nonprofit financial situations are on a downward spiral. So what effect does this have on the sector's performance abilities?
Yeah, I think what I'll start with first is kind of why we're seeing an increase in demand, right? As you've already talked about, like we're coming out of the pandemic. There's an affordability crisis that inflation incited. So actually we're seeing more and more people just generally turn to nonprofits to continue to navigate a lot of the complex and ongoing social issues they're facing. So pandemic recovery, affordability crisis, in general, that offsets so many other things, more mental health support, more addiction support. We know there's been an increase in gender-based violence, so needing more supports around that. We also know people can't find affordable housing. That's huge. All types of care is increasing. People are getting older. They need care. We want, you know, universal child care, so we need to prep for that or make sure that's happening. Also, we're seeing immigration migration happen at historically high levels. And again, the sector's supporting with that in all senses of the word, or all senses of immigration. And there's this massive disruption of work. People are trying to figure out what does work mean for them. So employment and training is an all-time high. So all of these pieces are really, really pushing the increase in demand. And we know people end up relying even more on nonprofits during public health emergencies and climate emergencies, pandemic, wildfires, floods. They're reaching out to their local food banks and shelters and evacuation sites to be able to support around that. Or even, you know, reaching more to friendship centers, for instance, in Indigenous communities. And so all of these pieces drive demand. There's also been massive population shifts, which is connected to the immigration migration piece. People are leaving Toronto and the GTA because of the cost, and moving to other mid-sized cities in Ontario, like Kitchener-Waterloo, like London, like different cities in Niagara region, like Ottawa. And that social infrastructure there, which is our sector is a big part of, can't keep up. So you have a mass influx of people. You don't have the same funding or same level of service that you could do. Plus, perhaps you're not able to recruit and retain people, which we've seen in the numbers. So all of that is creating like this perfect storm for demand. And so the impact of that ends up being, you're, like you said, you're cutting back programs or your waitlists continue to grow. And sometimes, you know, we've seen people even shut their waitlists off because they're like, what's the point? Like you're going to keep someone on a waitlist for 6 months, or people or organizations are shutting down. They're just not able to sustain themselves or not able to bridge the gaps in money and resources needed to keep afloat like they used to in the past, because times have changed. Charitable donations are down, and it's harder to do sort of fundraising in-person galas, as well as, you know, funding again hasn't kept up, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit anyways. And so all of these sort of pieces come together. Another thing to really think about is that, for, you know, a lot of times other industries will say, well, we're also experiencing a labor shortage. We're also having difficulty recruiting, retaining people, or we're also, you know, experiencing inflation and affordability crisis. So what, why is it different for you, right? Or what makes us unique? And I think what I like to say back to that is we're, as a sector, I think at much more whims of our context than others are. So if there's economic uncertainty, that's directly going to mean less government money and spending and less charitable giving. If there's like uncertainty around, or rather there's like a crisis happening, an emergency, that means that we're going to see an increase in demand for services, right? And so those pieces usually aren't the case for others. And when I say we're going to experience an increase in demand, or, you know, thinking about inflation, we experience it in two ways. When our community is impacted, needs go up, and then our operational costs generally, because we're operating in this space, our costs go up. And so we hear a lot of stories around, you know, organizations having to do more with less. Your front line is burnt out because they're trying to pick up the slack. There's low morale. People are disconnected from the work. They're experiencing vicarious trauma because it's difficult work, right? Like, it's not like you're getting paid $16 at McDonald's. You're getting paid sometimes $16 to house people, or to find them food, or to help them through really traumatic experiences. And they're picking up slack because of just there's not enough people. Middle management and leaders are not just grappling with, you know, how do we provide services in this space, but also taking care of their staff, taking care of the board, doing advocacy. And at times, if they're a smaller organization, the ED is doing HR and finance and everything else on top of their expertise. So all in all, we just end up seeing a huge burnt out system, like I said, running on fumes, that's trying their best to hold everything together. And I will mention that, you know, it might not seem like, oh, well, this small nonprofit closed in, I don't know, Canada, but it matters because that means there's a sect of people, or a community, or a group of people that no longer have access to service. And it might have been a really, really niche program. Perhaps it got picked up by another neighboring organization or community agency. But the question then arises, do they have the funds to now also deliver that programming? Do they have the people to be able to deliver that programming? And sometimes things don't get replaced. If an aquatics program shuts down in a small community, is that going to get replaced? Is another swimming pool going to be built? Or magically, we're going to grow some more lifeguards so kids can learn swimming? Not necessarily, right? So a lot of these pieces, even though small, are really important. And the long-term impact that we stress to government all the time is that one nonprofit closure leaves a tear in our social safety net. These are going to be gaping holes, and it just drives up costs and demand on other care institutions, like the hospitals, like the long-term care, like jails, like treatment centers. And we already know those are at capacity and cannot take on more. So it really is about how do we strengthen the sector, because we play such an important and critical and really specific part in this whole sort of care continuum, if you think about it in that way.
So if all of this is happening and nonprofits clearly play an important role in community, then why is it funded so inadequately?
Lots of reasons. But I think there's this misconception that back in the day, you know, a bunch of people, probably women, got together in their basement and said, you know, we're going to do some charity work, out of the goodness of our hearts. And that's sort of the model that perpetuates that, because it's charitable work, because so many women do it, it should be done for free. It's sort of, you know, on the side, it's not that important. And it doesn't cost a lot. So I think that big myth around charity work really, really impacts us as well. The other reason is, I think it's just flatlined. A lot of funding that for a lot of the social services has been flatlined by government for the past 2 decades. And so it just hasn't kept up pace generally with cost of living and how much it costs to deliver these services, let alone, you know, when you see the massive peaks right now in terms of demand and inflation. And so that really contributes to it. There's been some gains made in the last couple of years, but not for everybody, for very, very different parts of the sector. And so I think those two pieces coming together, I think just generally also the value we've talked a lot about. We started the podcast off like, who are we? What do? What's our value? That's largely unrecognized in the general public. If you were, like you said, you go to someone and say, what's a nonprofit? They're not going to know, or they have like really weird misconceptions about us. And so if there's no value, there's no recognition and acknowledgement, it's really hard to translate that into resources that sustain communities. And to be quite frank, we often are servicing communities that people don't care about. You know, homelessness, food banks, all of that. So that in that sense of urgency or that sense of urgency and that public support sometimes is missing because it's not on their radar. So I think it's all those pieces. And I think, you know, we also had an opportunity with this survey to do some 4-year projections. To your point, like, is nothing changing? If nothing changes, you know, what sort of happens? And so we did the math, back of the envelope math, but we did the math. If policymakers continue to ignore, decision makers continue to ignore the sector and don't support it and sustain it in the way that we need it to, the numbers are really, really awful and scary. It means that by 2026, every single nonprofit in Ontario will be experiencing an increase in demand for service. Only 17% of the sector is going to be able to forecast financial sustainability for over a year. And nonprofits will see a 131% increase in costs. Excuse me. And lastly, 63% of the sector will know of another similar organization shutting down. So can you imagine, like, what communities and neighborhoods are going to look like in 2026 if this is the case? Like, where will people go? And if more and more is handed off to the for-profit sector, and, you know, sometimes, yeah, if more and more is handed off to the for-profit sector, if they're not making money off of it anymore, they will probably leave. And another sort of, you know, so it's not sustainable in that sense either. So that's what we're up against. Like, that's why this moment is so different. And I think, again, to your findings as well, it's scary times, and it could get scarier if nothing changes.
Yeah, I agree. It could get scarier. It sounds like it. You know, Canada's population is rapidly growing. And what are we going to do if we don't have people to help everybody, you know, help build these communities and settle these communities and offer services for kids? You know, people want to make money so they can move into these communities. But then what happens when they don't exist? What happens when there's nobody to upkeep them?
Right.
So then what sort of changes need to be made in order for this sector to flourish and work at its full capacity? And I think we've already answered it, but why should people care?
Yeah. So we have 5 policy recommendations that came out of our report that we're advocating for and asking the sector to amplify and advocate, as well as our allies. So the first one is we're advocating for a home in government for the sector in the provincial government. So what this means is we're looking for an associate minister or a deputy minister or something of that sort in the economic development, job creation and trade ministry to sort of be that champion in government, in cabinet particularly, who gets the sector, knows what they do, can take a whole of government approach, and really connect the dots and see, you know, everything that I've talked about, who we are, and champion that and bring that perspective to a lot of the key policymaking that's done in the province. Right now, nonprofits work with 16 different ministries at a time, and that's just like your line ministries, like Ministry of Health, MCCSS. So it's not about recreating those relationships, but it's about how do we elevate and sustain those relationships, but also what about those, like, labor and Treasury Board Secretariat, like those pieces that really, like, funding that impact everybody. So home and government is one piece. The second piece is just generally we want better transfer payment agreements for the sector. So if there's any funding agreement between government and a nonprofit, to just be better, to include true cost of delivery, for it to be flexible and on par with funding that they might give to the public sector to do the same job, same work. So that trickles down to better services, better social infrastructure, and just better pay. So we're able to recruit and retain people. We are particularly asking for investment in nonprofits and grassroots groups that serve equity deserving communities. So our partners in Black Led, Black Serving, Black Focus organization, our partners in I4, so Indigenous Led Partnership, Informed Benefiting Organizations, and 2SL, LGBTQIA+, as well as women's organizations, because we know they're on the front lines and those communities have been historically harmed. We're also asking for broader support around developing a labor force strategy and a workforce development plan to combat a lot of the stuff that we talked about, HR crisis, burnout. You know, we're also in this age of where technology is here, AI is here. And so how do we grapple with that with the sector? And we need some support because we're in this constant cycle of chaos and crisis and haven't had a chance to sort of pause from that. And then the last thing that we're asking for is modernizing volunteerism. Half the sector actually is volunteer driven. So only half of the sector has paid staff. Everybody else has volunteer staff. They might have one or two here, but we rely on volunteers so much in our sector, from the volunteer board members to helping with programs. And that's so connected to civic engagement and engaging in local communities, which is connected to thriving democracies and faith in public institutions. So if we don't have volunteerism, we kind of don't have that civic engagement space like we used to 10, 15, 20 years ago. And that's a threat to our democracy and our public institutions, which we're already seeing. Also, people donate where they volunteer. So if they're not volunteering, they're not donating. And so we're asking the province to think about a volunteer recovery strategy, or really shift how we think about volunteerism. It's not, you know, you go down to your local food bank anymore and you volunteer in person, but young people are engaging in volunteerism in much different ways. So how do we sort of make sure our strategy reflects that? So those are all the things that we're asking for. They're really underlying a lot of things what others in the sector are asking for. They're a bit more high level. But these are the pieces I think if we were to put in place could really make a significant impact on our sector and the way in which we serve communities.
That sounds like fair things that need to be changed, you know, be treated equally and important, paid fairly, and be modernized with aspects of our industry like volunteerism. Those would seem like such small asks, but I bet that they're not. So for those interested in learning more about this kind of stuff and ONN's fantastic work, where should they go?
Yes. So best place to reach us and connect with us is our website. So it's www.theonn.ca. It has all our resources. We don't gatekeep. Everything's free and available. Government submissions, blogs, as well as projects and resources and toolkits that we're working on. You can also check out nonprofitresources.ca, and this is really good for organizations or grassroots groups that want to figure out like the day-to-day stuff, how to operate a nonprofit, how to incorporate, how to get charitable status. I also encourage people to follow us on our Twitter handle as well as Instagram. Our comms team is always posting cool and fun stuff. And the best way to sort of know what's happening right when it happens is subscribing to our e-newsletter. So we publish an e-bulletin every 2 weeks, which has all policy updates federally and provincially, as well as stuff that's happening in the network.
Well, that's all of our time, Pamela. So thank you for being here and thanks for sharing. And a big thank you to ONN for all the work that they do. And it was great getting to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
And thank you all for tuning in today as well. If you want to learn more about our work surrounding the nonprofit sector, visit our website at workforcecollective.ca and check out the featured publication sector under Tools and Resources tab. And don't forget to check out ONN's website at theonn.ca. Workforce Collective and ONN invite you to follow us along our journey through LinkedIn, Twitter, or visit our websites at workforcecollective.ca and theonn.ca. Be sure to check out ONN's super insightful podcast called Digging In with ONN for more discussions like this. You can find them anytime on Apple Podcasts. And stay tuned for more episodes of the Workforce Collective podcast. You can find us on YouTube, on Spotify, or just say, Alexa, play the Workforce Collective podcast. Thank you all for being here.